Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 29th, 2013. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby from BeerAndWineJournal.com talks about his extensive series on brewing hoppy American pale ales. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, BasicBrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. I'm on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. Our show page is on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. And thanks again, everybody, clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of shopping on Amazon, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our Amazon link. It will take you to Amazon. You'll be shopping as you normally do. The only difference is that we get some support from that. We greatly appreciate that. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, we're on the Stitcher app, and we're on the Windows Phone directory, too. Check out our brewer's logbook at basicbrewingshop.com. On the front of the book, in the front of the book, is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. And it's coming into brewing season, so you need to get those now. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who has done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com as well. Well, I'm going to get right to it. Chris and I had a lot to cover on one of my favorite topics, brewing hoppy beers. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me on, James.
This is your first, I guess, official appearance as founder, editor, publisher, what the
raconteur.
What's your title of BeerAndWineJournal.com? And we have passed an important milestone recently.
Which milestone?
It starts with a one and ends with two zeros.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there's two. We just hit our 2 month mark, but right at a couple days before that we hit our 100 post mark.
Yeah.
So we've put up 100 articles on beer and wine and mead and occasionally food on beerandwinejournal.com.
And I'm responsible for what, 6 of those? My percentage is not very good.
I'm not counting right now. So I don't know.
You're a powerhouse. And boy, the stuff that you've been putting out there is really good. I mean, it's you are essentially just writing a book on how to brew and how to make wine and mead, you know, just as you go along. It's the depth of the material that you've been posting is just wonderful, and you know, from recipes to techniques to equipment to, you know, you name it, it's all good stuff, and it's attracting a lot of attention. We've gotten a lot of visitors, a lot of people spending time on the website. It's fun to look at Google Analytics, and we can see live on Google Analytics where people are from. Can't see who you are, but we can see where you're from, and you know, we get visitors from all over the world. And I think one of the most important statistics is that well over half of the people who are coming to the site are repeat visitors. So that I think that's a really good thing, that we are attracting an audience that is sticking around and coming back. So congratulations.
Yeah, so far so good. I mean, we're trying to present sort of a daily journal of homebrew information, and we're trying to you know, realize that there are people brand new to the hobby, very excited, and you know, sometimes what we convey is somewhat basic. We also have keep in mind that there are people like me and you who have been homebrewers for a long time, and we're hungry for more, you know, knowledge that's not out there or breaking sort of stuff. And so far, people seem to like it.
And we've been getting good feedback, good comments on the site as well, which we answer. So it's fun to have another venue in which we can interact with homebrewers out there. But one thing that you have done that I think is monumental on the site is this, what is it, a 10-part series, 10-part series on American pale ales?
Yeah, there was 8 or 9 main articles, and there were a couple supplementary pieces. Yeah, I did a piece on or a series on I just called it American Hoppy Ales, and that would encompass pale ales, Americanized style IPAs, and double IPAs. And we went through everything from, you know, what sort of water to use, what minerals to put in your water, you know, and then of course malt, and then of course, you know, there was like 4 or 5 different hop related articles. What varieties are best? What when to add them? Different hopping techniques. And yeah, I think that was a pretty comprehensive package in the end. It got a lot of information out there about a style that, or a cluster of styles that, you know, homebrewers are excited about.
Yeah, I think it's one of the styles that people are going to want to do first and often when they start brewing. Let's start from the beginning. You deconstructed the beers, the style, or the styles. Let's start with water. And when we were talking about the best water for nice, hoppy American beers, what are we talking about?
Well, you've got a couple things to consider. The first, of course, is whether you're extract brewing or all-grain brewing. And one thing I'm trying to click up the link so I can.
You're cheating.
I'm trying to cheat, but apparently I can't navigate my own website very well.
That's beerandwinejournal.com.
Beerandwinejournal.com.
And what we will probably do is make a page with links to all this separate articles and sub-articles and all that on there. That'll help people navigate to that, and we'll post that this week as we post the episode. That's probably a good thing to do whenever we do, you know, one of these all-encompassing series of articles like this, so that people can find it easily. The search field works really well on the site.
Yeah, it actually does.
How I found it, but then you link to previous articles and next articles within the series. So if you find yourself in the middle, you can find yourself out one way or the other.
Right. So getting back to water, depends on if you're all grain brewer or extract. If you're malt extract brewer, your water is going to have, or your malt extract is going to have whatever minerals that are required to get, you know, the mash pH in order and all that, because, you know, they've done that for you. So your water needs for that aren't very, or at least initially aren't that stringent. Just carbon filter your water and or treat it with a Camden tablet to get rid of the chloramines. If you're making an all-grain beer, you, of course, need to treat your water with enough calcium and reduce the level of carbonate, or which is sometimes reported in your water treatment guide as bicarbonate, or sometimes it's listed as alkalinity as HCO3, which HCO3 is bicarbonate. Anyway, you need to reduce the level of carbonates, bring up the level of calcium if either of those are out of whack, so that your pH drops. And the interesting thing, though, and something that's applicable to both all-grain brewers and extract brewers, is the ratio of chloride in your water to sulfate has an effect on the perception of bitterness. So if you're adding calcium to your water, either as an all grain brewer or as an extract brewer. You can add a little bit. The more, well, backing up, when you add minerals to your water, you have a couple different choices. Two very popular ones are calcium chloride and calcium sulfate. So by choosing which one of those you add to your water, you can skew the ratio. But basically, the more you skew it towards sulfate, within reason at least, the more it accentuates the hoppiness. So for all grain brewers, you're going to want to get your water report from your local water utilities. You know, and then, like I said before, lower the carbonates if you need to, bring up the calcium, but do so in such a way that you end up with, you know, maybe a 2-to-1 or maybe even a 3-to-1 excess of sulfate. And for extract brewers, your extract is going to have an unknown mix of minerals in it, so you don't know. So your best bet is just to add a small amount of gypsum, of calcium sulfate, because you're going to expect there to be some chloride in the water already. Put some gypsum in there, the sulfate, that'll enhance the bitterness. And that can be something that takes, you know, a lot of people, I think, are a little nervous about jumping into water chemistry because it can be kind of confusing. But if you're looking to brew like a really, really good hoppy ale, sort of one of the last things to experiment is playing around with your water chemistry a little bit, you know, changing up the minerals that are in it. It can really make a difference.
And this ratio that you're talking about is fairly new information, isn't it?
Yeah. It originated in, there was can't think of the name right now. But if you Google chloride to sulfite ratio and brewing, somewhat old, like 70s school textbook pops up and they discuss it, and it's only like a quick paragraph. But sort of recently, homebrewers have taken it and ran with it, and you know, did some experiments. And I mean, John Palmer has done a lot with it. His little downloadable water chemistry spreadsheet, you know, the Excel spreadsheet that you can download for free from his site, has a whole bunch of stuff about on that. And yeah, so it originated as something that pro brewers knew and felt compelled enough about it to put it in, you know, a couple paragraphs in a textbook of theirs. And yeah, it's something that homebrewers in the past, I don't know, 5 years, something like that. I don't know the timeline exactly, but fairly recently have picked up on.
Now, when you talk about one good thing that you do in the articles is you kind of separate out American pale ales with American IPAs, with American double IPAs. So would you want to tailor that ratio differently between those styles?
You know, that's something that people could experiment with. But, you know, for me, you could probably just make one kind of water and it's going to be good for, you know, you're mashing a pale beer in every case. And the, you know, the overall differences in color are not going to be that great. You know, you'll have a little bit more crystal malt in a pale ale than you will in an IPA, and even less in a double IPA. But you know, from the standpoint of mash pH, your water can be the same. And then from the standpoint of accentuating the hops, you don't need to go all in on the ratio. You know, you don't need to move it all the way to the most extreme edge. Just, you know, because your hops are going to be what are supplying the bitterness. It's just the chloride to sulfate ratio is just going to be, how is that accentuated? Mm. How does that come off on your palate? So yeah, I would say, and I mean, I haven't. That would actually be a fun experiment sometime. Is to, it's funny you mentioned that, because one thing I don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows, is if you can do this after the fact. Like, can you brew your beer and then add some gypsum sand bottling and have that work. And one experiment I thought of was brew a pale ale or an IPA, whatever, but brew it with a sort of neutral chloride to sulfide ratio. Sulfate and sulfides are very different things. Brew the beer with 5 gallons of beer, add a neutral, bottle a gallon of it, sprinkle a little gypsum in your bottling bucket, bottle another gallon of it, sprinkle a little more, have it calculated out so that you're moving, the notch, substantially enough that you could see it if the effect is real, and bottle essentially 5 different levels of, chloride to sulfide ratio post brewing, and see if that does anything. That would be interesting because I honestly don't know.
Yeah, that'd be fun. And that way you could kind of say if you've got a beer in the keg that's not – that the hops aren't accentuated enough, you could theoretically fix it.
Right, if that works. And I don't know if it's something that the minerals interact with the hops as they're being boiled and it affects, the alpha acid extraction. In that case, adding it afterwards would not help.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know if it's just something that on the palate – it has some effect.
Put that on the list of things to do.
Yeah. No, I think that would be a good one. I've been brewing and or mead making and wine making quite a bit recently, but I thought that experiment would be a good one. And then I'd also have 5 gallons of pale ale at the end of it, so.
Yeah. Let's talk about fermentables. What's the, either the malt bill or the extract bill for this these styles?
Well, the base maltin is always going to be American two row. You can vary things up by adding a little bit of Pilsner malt if you want to, have it so a blend of base malts. You can add a little Vienna malt if you want, a little Munich malt is something that people spice up the base malt with. Then generally in a lot of formulations, there's only one specialty malt, and it's just crystal malt, and it usually right around 40 Lovibond, but I mean, they're certainly lighter, especially in the stronger, in the double IPAs. For classic pale ale, about 10% of, crystal malt of 30 to 40 degrees Lovibond. For IPA, maybe 5 to 7% in that range of, and then maybe that's would be maybe crystal 20 to 30, and then for double IPAs, it's really better to get your amount, your percentage of crystal malts fairly low because you want to make the wort fermentable. You're going to start at a fairly high gravity, and you want to finish at a low enough gravity that the beer is dry enough that these sort of hops are accentuated. If you add a bunch of crystal malt or don't succeed at getting the wort as fermentable as you can, or you do a poor job of attenuating the beer, you end up sort of with a barley wine,
mm-hmm.
Which may not be bad if you like barley wine, but it's a thicker, barley wines have a thicker mouthfeel. They're a little sweeter, and whereas they can be quite hoppy, it's the flavor and overall character of a barley wine is very different than a double IPA.
Yeah, you don't want the hops to be bright. You want the beer to be bright, especially like in a double IPA, like you're saying. If you put a bunch of grain in the mash tun, you were going to wind up with a bunch of unfermentable sugars at the end. Even if you mash at a low temperature, you're still going to get a bunch of sugars, in the beer at the end. So you want it to be the wort to be as fermentable as possible, and adding a whole bunch of crystal malt in the beginning of it's not going to help you out there.
Yeah, when you're making a double IPA, you definitely want to focus on when you're making an IPA, the sweet wort. You definitely want to focus on fermentability. Keep the amount of crystal malt low. Some brewers even supplement, or not supplement, but switch a portion of their pale malt with just sugar that they add in the kettle, because that's 100% fermentable, and that makes for a more fermentable wort. And some, even most of these beers, you know, and especially the American Pale Ale and IPA, you can just do a single infusion mash, and that works perfectly. Some brewers of IPAs or double IPAs, additionally, will go through a longer step mash. You know, they'll have an initial low rest at, you know, somewhere between 140 and 145, and then ramp it up to, you know, the mid 150s later. But you know, they'll have a long rest at a lower temperature, and then this produces a very dry beer.
And you can learn some lessons from the Belgians when you're working with a beer of this high gravity. If you want it to be nice and sort of drier and more drinkable, you can look at, say, a Belgian triple fermentable recipe. You know, and they've got a bunch of grain in there, but they've also got a bunch of sugar in there as well to dry up the beer. So if you compare, say, a Belgian triple to an American barley wine, they may have both have the same amount of alcohol, but the barley wine is going to be a lot more sort of syrupy and have a heavier mouthfeel, while the triple is going to be a lot easier to drink.
Right. In a double IPA, both your recipe formulation and your mashing procedure is going to contribute to fermentability. And the triple is a good example of varying the recipe, because that's exactly what they do for that beer. Is they, you know, they have a bunch of it's usually Pilsner malt as the base, and sometimes the only malt, and then they just cut it a little bit with sugar that they add in the kettle, and that makes for a beer that finishes at a relatively low final gravity, so that your trip to Belgium is very, very exciting.
This is really nice.
Now, if you're an extract brewer and you want to make a fairly high gravity beer like a double IPA, different extracts are going to have different fermentability, right?
Yeah, they can, and that's one thing you should you should go back and look over your brewing notebook, which you should have recorded, you know, what your recipe was and what kind of malt extracts you used, and looked for ones that had a higher degree of fermentability. One thing you can do, though, in a double IPA or even an IPA to increase the fermentability of your extract wort is basically do a partial mash. And that'll help you for a couple reasons. One is you'll just be making part of the wort from scratch, or not from scratch. You haven't malted the grains, but you're making the grains or part of your wort from malt, and part of just by dilution, you'll have a higher fermentability. But you can also then you take that wort and when you start stirring in your malt extract, before you heat it up, you know, hold that at about 150 degrees and stir in, you know, as much as your malt extract as you're going to boil initially. You know, you'll probably be withholding some for a late addition, but stir in the whatever malt extract you have initially and let that sit for about 5 minutes at 150 degrees. The enzymes in the partial mash wort are going to degrade any carbohydrates from the malt extract in the same way they would from, you know, as the same way they would in a grain bed. Hmm. So you could just use, you know, a small partial mash, you know, in addition to lowering your fermentability, in addition to adding the aroma of base malt, which is many times lacking in a pale ale. Well, additionally, you can use those enzymes to sort of chew up any, or not any, but you can chew up some of the less fermentable carbohydrates in extract. That's sort of little known trick, right, that Bob Hansen from Brees told me one time.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the reason, I guess, that some malt extracts have a lower level of fermentability, in other words, more unfermentable sugars left over, is that I take it that a lot of times they are made in these kit and kilo kits, you know, where you're going to add sugar anyway.
Right.
And also,
some of them are, yeah, formulated to have that fermentability because they're expecting you to add sugar. Yes.
Yeah. And also, you can make a lower gravity extract beer and have it be, you know, still have substantial mouthfeel because you've got those unfermentable sugars in there. So that's kind of by design that they're doing that.
I think so. I also think that, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I've been led to believe that just part of the process of removing the water from the extract, you know, it cooks it very slightly, and there are, I guess there are some chemical reactions that, you know, form some bigger sugars from simpler ones.
Interesting. So now the most important part, arguably, of the hoppy American ales are the hops.
Yes. That's as I finally got around to like the sixth part in the series, it was like, oh, thank God we got the hops finally.
But without a good base, you're not going to accentuate the hops. So
right.
It's all leading up to that. So how do we – first of all, what hops are we looking at?
Okay, what you want is the sort of the classic sort of American style hops, which are frequently described as having a citrusy edge to them, and sort of like the classic, the one that Jack McAuliffe started using with New Albion Ale, and the one that Ken Grossman used when he formulated Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, which was sort of the kickoff to the American pale ale story. That was the first one that really caught on and started catching people's imagination. But anyway, Cascade hops.
Mm-hmm.
Cascade hops have a citrusy, some people describe it as a slightly grapefruity edge to them. And you want hops that either are Cascade or are like Cascade or work well with Cascade. And a couple that work very well are some of the so-called sea hops. Centennial, which was actually bred to sort of be a super Cascade, higher alpha version of Cascade, that has a very similar flavor and aroma and works very well with Cascades. Chinook is another American hop. Chinook has a very distinct, I'm sure you've had Chinook beers before. There's sort of a love it or hate it description or character to those. Columbus is another one. Columbus, sometimes also called CTZ, because Tomahawk and Zeus varieties of hops are the same thing as Columbus, so they're sort of lumping them all back together now. That has a aroma that people describe as a dank, if you know what that word is. If you don't, yeah, children, go ask your parents. And any of those tend to work pretty good. They've all got some element of that citrusy American character. And other ones that work good are Amarillo and Autumn. Amarillo has a very strong citrus note. And it's one to me that I think that's the most grapefruity of them, but some people describe it as or passion fruit, or there's just a couple other descriptors, and it seems to be
mango.
Yeah, people have different descriptions or different impressions of it, but Amarillo is one that really pairs well with Cascade. Autumn's another, a little bit more restrained, but it's got a nice floral citrusy hop.
Mosaic is also good.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. For bittering hops, I like Simcoe. Simcoe's a high alpha variety. It's less citrusy. Simcoe is more piney, which seems to work because just blends well. And then, yeah, there's Summit, there's Citra, there's just a lot of hops. And then, of course, if you just need bitterness, you can also blend in some neutral hops to neutral or noble hops always blend well because they're, you know, the whatever the character of the other hop is going to be what shows up, and just you'll get the bitterness from them. But yeah, basically the hops you want are in these three styles. You know, if you're brewing them to be a characteristic example of them, you want the citrusy American, the sea hops, or Amarillo Autumn, and you know, various others.
Now, the when to use them is another good question. I mean, the you know, your choosing of the hops is wide open to you, but also when to add them in the process is another question that's going to be answered differently by whoever you talk to, probably.
Yeah, well, this is the fun part when you brew these beers is when someone asks you, you know, when do you add your hops, you can pretty much just say yes. You know, what stage are you at? Yeah, add some hops here. You know, the most beers that you brew, you know, you hop during the boil. And there are different approaches to hopping during the boil, ranging from, you know, some brewers add their bittering hops at the beginning of the boil. Then they wait till knockout, you know, add a second big batch for flavor and aroma. And, you know, that sort of bookend approach is how some people do it. Other people hop, you know, intermittently throughout the boil. You know, a classic homebrewer formulation of a beer is a, you know, addition at 60 minutes, one at 15, and one at, you know, sometime in the last 5 minutes. And then, you know, that was carried to the extreme and made famous by Dogfish Head, who started their, you know, 60, 90, and 120-minute series where the beers hopped throughout the entire boil. And that's an interesting way of doing it, because to some people's thought, you know, you've got what you have in hops is alpha acids, and you've got oils, and the oils are very volatile, and in contrast, the alpha acids need to be boiled for a long time to be extracted. So you're sort of at odds at what to do, and so that's why some people have the early edition bittering hops. The idea is you boil those for a long time, you extract the alpha acids. And you're not that worried about the oils, because most of them are going to, not all of them, but most of them are going to boil off during the duration of the boil. Then late in the boil, you add a bunch of hops that you've chosen for their floral characteristics, their, you know, their aroma, because they're going to be added to the wort, you know, either at knockout or boiled for only a few minutes. And, you know, the idea there is you get the nice oils out of them, but you're not that worried about the alpha acids because, you know, you've boiled them at the beginning. So some people would say in the middle of the boil, it's sort of the vomit zone when it comes to hopping. You know, you're not getting the full extraction of the of your alpha acids, and you're boiling away most of your oils because they're, you know, the oils are going to, you know, the bulk of them are going to it's, you know, it's just a simple chemical reaction there. The bulk of the oils are going to leave the kettle fairly quickly. So, you know, some people would say that, you know, you're just it's the worst of both worlds. Why add hops then? But other people claim that you get a character from the hops in a sort of mid-boil addition that you don't from other hopping methods, mm-hmm. with a sort of bookending method. But, you know, when you go to the beer store, there's, you know, Dogfish 60 is sitting there, and they've certainly been successful. So it does work to add hops throughout the boil. On the other hand, sitting next to it is probably, you know, Stone IPA, which is hops at the beginning, hops at the end, you know, so that works too. So it's just, it's not the case of, you know, there's a right or wrong here. There's, it's just how do you want to handle it in your brew house? How do you, you know, what character are you looking for? And you know, for people who really like this style, they'll be brewing these beers frequently, and you know, hopefully trying a little something different, you know, every once in a while and see what they like.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, some homebrewers even like there's a technique. Taken from the idea of whirlpool hopping, and some homebrewers have named it hop bursting, where you basically boil your wort and then you just add, you know, just a metric, you know, beep pile of of hops right at the end. And, you know, you let them whirlpool for a while, and because you've added so many of them, just being in the wort above 185 degrees, there's going to be enough alpha acid extraction that you get the alphas that you need. But you also get, you know, because you've added a ton of them, the aroma you need. So there's a lot of ways to add hops during the boil.
Yeah, that's the
and
theory.
And that's only part of it for these beers.
That's the theory behind the 15-minute pale ale. The recipe of which you can find on the site, beerandwinejournal.com. It was one of, if not the first article that I wrote for the website. It's a recipe that a lot of people have done with great success. It's just an extract beer where you only boil for 15 minutes and add all of your hops in those 15 minutes, and you just double up on the amount of bittering hops that you would have boiled for 60 minutes, add them at 15 minutes, and then, you know, load up the end of the boil with tasty American hops as well. And that sort of leads us into the next thing of figuring out how much hops to add. And you advocate starting at the end of the process and working your way back in time to figure out how much hops to add, right?
Yeah. I always, and this is not to say that you have to do this, but it's just a way that I think makes sense, and that I would tell people, yeah, start with your late edition hops. And, you know, most people these days, when they're formulating a recipe, you know, you'll have your online calculator, like, you know, Beer Tools or Strange Brew or whatever you're using, or if you have your own little spreadsheet that you made for yourself. Choose, you know, start by choosing the amount of aroma hops that you're going to add in the late in the boil. Put those in and then see what level of bitterness you get to. If you're adding anything, you know, that's even boiled for a little while, or if you're going to do a whirlpool and your calculator actually supports those calculations, that you'll see you'll see the level of IBUs that your late additions get you, and then just round that out by the bitterness with your bitterness addition. And then, of course, you also have to consider later your dry hops and your Randall hops and your mash hops and your hops in your hop jack if you're adding them that way. Or
and it depends on which bitterness IBU calculator you use as opposed to, you
know. Yeah.
There are lots of variables.
One thing in the article that's it's not original to me, but it was someone thought it up and had told me about it a while back, was there's one sort of way to get one last little blast of hops into your beer, and that's by making a French press extract.
Oh, yeah.
And what you can do is, let's say you've got beer, you've brewed it, you know, you hopped it in the kettle, fermented it, racked it to secondary onto some dry hops, and now it's time to, let's say you're bottling it. What you can do is, you've got to add sugar in the bottling process for the bottle conditioning anyway. Why not make it hopped wort, you know? So what you do is just boil, you know, figure out how much sugar you need, and then you sort of have to eyeball it, because some of that sugar is going to get entrained in the hops in this process. But, you know, just take a stab at it and bump up the amount of sugar you need a little bit, you know, and add it as malt extract, boil the malt extract, and then what you do is you have a French press, and you just pack in however much hops you want into the French press, pour the boiling wort on that, let that sit for 5 to 15 minutes. That'll, you know, they'll get the a lot of the oils out, and then press that off, and then use that hopped wort as your priming sugar, because the sugar in there will be consumed by the yeast as it normally is in a bottle conditioning, but the hop oils and all that are added are, you know, trapped in the bottle. They're not going on, you know, to be boiled and be boiled off. They're not going to fermentation. Well, they'll be. You do lose some hop oils during fermentation, just the act of the CO2 pushing them out. You know, you you typically don't lose much dry hopping because you've done that. But this is if it's bottling time, and you've pulled your dry hops out and you've tasted your beer and you've thought it just needs a little bit more, and then if you still need more hops, take a water filter canister and build yourself a Randall so that you can add hops the moment before you drink the beer.
Fermentation. Nothing especially fancy with the fermentation. In fact, the cleaner the better, right?
Yeah, the fermentation, when you get to that point, you're basically looking at straight-ahead ale fermentation. One thing you do want to consider is that the hops take some – or not the hops. The yeast will take some of the bitterness out of the beer. And so what you want to do is you want to slightly underpitch. You don't want to completely underpitch, because you do need the beer to – you've worked all that – you've worked in the mash and in your recipe formulation to make a highly fermentable wort, and you want to work in your fermentation to attenuate all that. But you want to pitch sort of the minimum amount of yeast that you'll be able to do that with. So that'll scrub less bitterness from the beer. And then, pick a clean ale yeast, one that's not going to kick out a bunch of fruity esters that, are just competing in the aroma with the hops. And, most people ferment the beer. Then you want to move it to secondary for dry hopping, because most people don't dry hop with the yeast still present. But fermentation in those beers is pretty straightforward.
And the yeast strain does make a difference, because I've done the same recipe back-to-back, same hoppy pale ale recipe, lots of, American hops late in the boil. And I did one with Savel US05, the American, the Chico strain.
Right.
And delicious, hoppy, fruity, citrusy. And then I brewed the next batch, and I discovered I didn't have that. What I did have was the SO4, the London ale yeast, fermented with that, and completely different beer. All those fresh, fruity, citrusy hop characteristics were just drug out of the beer by that yeast strain. So it's known for being very flocculent, and it just jumps out of the way when it's done. But apparently, at least in that experience, it took a lot of the hop character with it. So stick with the American ale yeast, in my opinion.
Yeah, the classic American hoppy beer, pale ale IPA, and et cetera strain is, the Chico strain, the one that, Y-Yeast 1056 came from, the White Labs 001 came from, that Fermentis US05 came from. That's the classic strain. There's a couple others, that are neutral American strains that are used quite a bit, and those work too. I mean, basically, if you're looking at descriptions of yeast, look for yeast that's neutral. Look for one that, is not advertised as accentuating the malt, because obviously that's getting you nowhere. You'll be in pretty good job, or you'll be in pretty good shape. I mean, there actually are some British and some Belgian ale yeasts that will work if you run a clean fermentation with them, if you manage the temperature and the pitching rate so that you get a clean character out of them. There are some that will do a good job. There's a brew pub in Austin here called Uncle Billy's, and they use the what strain is it? They use the Westmalle strain, the one that for the triple. They use it in many of their beers now, even ones that aren't Belgian-y. They just pitch enough yeast and control the temperature, and it does a nice neutral fermentation. So, which is kind of weird, because you think of that strain, and most people, you when you ferment with it, you start it out sort of warm, and then you might even let it climb a little bit, and you get those big Belgian the esters and a little bit of the phenolic spiciness. But, you know, like pitching a lot, aerating a little more, and controlling the temperature, especially, you can get a clean fermentation out of that yeast.
And last,
not that would be your first choice. I should go on and on about this, but you could do it if you know, let's say you just brewed a triple and you had a bunch of that on hand, you know.
Yeah, if you're a small brew pub or a small brewery, especially, and you're reusing your yeast, then that makes a lot of sense to do that.
Yeah, but some brewers try to keep, you know, have a house strain or just one or two yeast strains in the brew. Or in the, you know, on the fermentation side of their brewery, just so that they don't, you know, cross contaminate, and they don't. It also reduces the amount of yeast propagation you need to do. You know, if you're maintaining several strains, that's more work. So, yeah.
And last but not least, don't lay these beers down. If you've got a nice hoppy American ale, drink it.
Yeah, these aren't, you know. These aren't ones that you brew, and you know, with the idea that you're, you shouldn't be brewing them with the idea that, you know, you're going to lay these down in your cellar and you know, come back and enjoy them years later. The hop character starts to go away after a while. You know, some of the bigger ones, a double IPA, they can age fairly well just because they're bigger beers, but they certainly don't have the impact of the full fresh, you know, hops hitting you in the face after a while. They, you know, they'll still be, they might still be a worthwhile and interesting beer, but generally, you know, and especially with the pale ales and the IPAs, you know, brew them, dry hop them, get them into a keg or into bottles, you know, let them condition and, you know, drink it.
Keep them fairly cool and enjoy them fairly quickly.
Okay. You keep them out of the sun. unless you like skunk.
So that we've there are more details in the articles, and also there are recipes online. My sunflower ale recipe would fit in that category. If you look search for the word sunflower, just don't use sunflower seeds. Just use the two row that's in the recipe. There are lots of American hops in that one.
You've got some recipes too. Yeah, I posted my pale ale recipe. This is my homebrew recipe that I brewed like 20 or 30 times. And that's pretty much a straight up example. I also posted an example of a homebrew example of an IPA, which is pretty much a straight by the numbers IPA, you know, fit in the BJCP category. And then we also have a clone recipe for Stone's double dry hopped Ruination, which is a double IPA and a doubly hopped IPA. And of course, you can also brew the single dry hopped version from that recipe too. You just don't do the second dose of dry hopping. It's really quite simple.
Don't make it too hard. Well, very good. I look forward to further dispatches on the website. And you guys, if you have suggestions for stories or comments or whatever, there are links to our email addresses on the website. Think chris@beerandwinejournal.com. And I've also got one on there, james@beerandwinejournal.com. Then you know how to reach me through this podcast as well. So anyway, I look forward to the next 100 articles, and congratulations on maintaining your stamina so far.
Oh, thanks. I'm excited. I think this is going to be, a good, you know, venture. I think, you know, so far the reaction has been good. People seem to like it. You know, and hopefully things will go well in the future. You know, we've got more clone recipes coming down the pike. We've got, you know, we're going to periodically do beer style series. I'm going to do German wheat beers next because they're they're an ale that has a couple neat little twists in the brewing, where, you know, doing a ferulic acid rest and choosing a temperature to fermentation temperature to either accentuate the cloviness in the beer or the banana esters in the beer. And so that's a fun beer style. And yeah, we've got a lot of stuff going on, and we've got a lot of brewing going on. I've got a wine that I've made in progress. I've got a mead that I just made a couple days ago in progress. And I brewed my porter a couple weeks ago, and that needs to be kegged. And so we'll have little updates on just what we've been brewing. And I know that you just racked your Saison over to secondary.
Right. And I'm going to try. I think the next beer I'm going to do another 100% rye beer and see if I can get something that's not the mouthfeel of cough syrup.
Yeah.
But, yeah, lots coming down the pike.
Yeah, so not only, we'll have, how-to homebrew content on the page, but we'll also have sort of, what are Chris and James brewing, and hopefully, some commentary and insight based on what, actual practice.
So you'll see our most of, hopefully, successes and maybe every now and then a failure, too.
Yeah, if we quit mentioning something, just...
Whatever happened to that beer that you talked about?
Swirling down a drain somewhere.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Great to talk to him, as usual, and great to talk to him on record. We've been doing a lot of talking without a recorder going lately, planning and scheming for the beerandwinejournal.com site. He has been just cranking out some excellent stuff every day on beerandwinejournal.com. And sometimes more than one article a day. So congratulations again to Chris for passing that century mark of the number of articles. If you haven't taken a look, you're missing out a lot on a bunch of stuff. So, and I've done some articles on there, too. They're not half bad. Go to beerandwinejournal.com. If you have brewing questions... show suggestions or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available in our shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beers. You take it from place to place. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Don't forget our logbooks. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on the Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are John Cleese Wine for the Confused and Solid Brass Victorian Style Service Desk Bell. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site. The next time you feel like Amazon shopping, we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dutson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.